brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know what the massive tax cuts for the wealthy have done? You know what all of those tax breaks for Amazon, the fact that Amazon pays nothing in taxes, you know what it's done? It's allowed Jeff Bezos to break a record in California of purchasing the most expensive house in the state. That's right. Jeff Bezos bought David Geffen's house for a mere $165 million. $165 million for a place to live. In a country where we have people, in California especially, where the FEMA folks are charging the fire victims for the shacks that they've given them and are actually trying to get their money back away from them. Because all of their houses burned down. I mean, you stop and you think about just how screwed up things are, especially on the economic side. And that's just obscene to me. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the state of the economy and bang through some more obscenities, I've asked our good friend Pedro DaCosta to come talk with us. Pedro is a reporter at Market News. He's also a columnist for Forbes and Market Watch. Pedro, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. How are you, Rick?
Can you imagine a $165 million house?
Unbelievable. And but he's also got he turned the textile museum in Washington into his semi home for the opening of headquarters too, and he's there a couple days a year. So yeah.
Yeah, I'm so glad my children's education, is lessened and the opportunities that they have are lessened. So he can have a big house.
The Bezos story is pretty appalling.
Now, evidently, that $165 million is more than the $150 million last year for the Chartwell estate, which, if anybody who remembers the old Beverly Hillbillies show, that was the house in the Beverly Hillbillies program. $150 million for that shack. So there you go. Let's move on.
Well, what's obscene? Well, what's really crazy about it is how poorly, as we know, Amazon workers get treated, right? If Amazon was, some kind of a booming firm where the benefits at least trickle down internally, you could at least make some sort of case for him as a corporate leader. But that ain't the case.
No, and that's an excellent point. I mean, you go, how does he afford a $165 million house? By cheating his workforce.
Yeah.
But he earns it, though, Pedro. He works hard.
Well, he does get to hang out with Jerome Powell, apparently, who was present at his most recent shindig, along with Ivanka Trump and Jay Powell. I was very proud, actually. I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but Representative Katie Porter held up one of my Forbes blogs during the Powell testimony this week and called him out. So I was pretty excited about that.
Good for you. But Powell evidently said that Jerome Powell, he's the Federal Reserve Board chairman, said that the $1 trillion budget deficits that we've got are unsustainable. And my first thought was, oh, gee, you think?
Well, the thing about the Fed saying budget deficits are unsustainable is it's a little ironic because they talk out of both sides of their mouths in the sense that they don't want governments to cut spending rapidly because that would harm the economy, but at the same time they pay lip service to the notion that deficits are going to break the bank, which they're not. So,
yeah, I'm not. Look, just to clarify, I'm not against deficit spending when you're building infrastructure, when you're investing in education, when you're actually using the money to move us forward. And I go back to economics class 100 years ago. The professor was very clear. Deficit spending, good deficit spending is, when you lose your job, you go out and get a resume, a new suit, maybe some better skills. Bad spending, vacation to Hawaii. We seem to be spending a lot of money on vacationing in Hawaii.
Exactly right. And the quality of spending matters, a ton. And as we blew out the deficit at a time where the economy was still not great, but slowly improving. And when we hit you know, a rougher patch, which we eventually will sooner, probably sooner than later, you know, you'll probably get the cries from Republicans saying that we have it. Hey, you don't even need to wait for a downturn. We've already got the Trump budget this week.
Right. I mean, you're right. Didn't we hear that on Monday? That we've got to make these cuts because we've spent your money.
And he's not even he's confident enough, or the Republicans are confident enough in their voter suppression, as described in your earlier segment with Greg Fallis, that they seem to be confident that they can go after that so-called third rail of politics and Social Security and still do well in November. So that's their plan.
Yeah, but don't you think that third rail is no longer the third rail that it used to be? I mean, when my grandparents' generation were front and center. The World War II, the little older than World War II generation, the people who, you know, just really got it. My grandmother would have beat you with her walker if you'd have threatened to take Medicare or Social Security away. Now I think the seniors that are retiring are like, oh, okay, well, as long as it's, you know, those folks down the road, yeah, screw the grandkids. They don't need it.
Well, I think the part that worries me more is not even the seniors who screw the grandkids, but actually the younger folks who maybe don't think it will be there for them, and therefore, you know, mistakenly so, and therefore might kind of be more amenable to cuts and think that cuts are kind of natural.
To give you an example, just today, actually, my wife brought up the fact that, you know, will Social Security be around for us? And I'm only, what, 15 years away? And I'm going, no, it'll be there. It'll be fine. It will be fine as long as we don't do anything really stupid.
No, it'll definitely be there. Even if we do a lot of stupid stuff, it'll still be there. That's not one of the problems that we're facing. So,
but here's the thing. I mean, when you start talking about these big numbers, and look, the Tea Party people who are non-existent today, and I still wonder where my don't tread on me flag waving morons of the Obama era are, because this guy is spending money on stuff that we're not getting any benefit from. Massive tax cuts for huge corporations and the wealthy so that people like Bezos can buy $165 million shacks. We're spending huge amounts of money on the military-industrial complex. And for what? Still not sure. And all the while, we're attacking public education. We're attacking healthcare. We're attacking, you know, not doing anything on infrastructure. It just seems like everything's going in the wrong direction. And yet, not a peep out of those folks.
That's right, and it's in the wrong direction, and it's very much against public opinion, curiously. I saw a statistic today that was pretty fascinating, which was the fact that the 48 senators that voted to, I don't know if you saw this one, 48 senators that voted to convict Donald Trump in the Senate represent 18 million more people than the 52 senators that voted to acquit. And that speaks a lot to how the country is being ruled politically, I think. So to that point, you know, you have a lot of people who support social programs, who support expanded health care, who certainly support Social Security and Medicare. And yet there's, you know, political hay to be made by advocating cuts because the fringe is so powerful.
Yeah, but, you know, here this week it comes out that Pete Buttigieg is talking deficit reduction and talking about, you know, the same kind of, you know, we got to worry about the debt, and we, you know, the kind of, you know, Obama thought of austerity and, you know, hey, we can't do too much. I'm of the mindset, you know, we can do a lot, especially now that we're, you know, we're not Greece, but, you know, we have to do it in a smart way.
I thought it was a lot worse than Obama, actually, because, I mean, you know, Obama was facing a ton of pressure. He was already president, and he did spend, and he did advocate for deficit spending. And then after he faced a heap of criticism, he had to, you know, he had austerity kind of forced upon him. Buttigieg is kind of throwing it up there. He's kind of trying to create that lane for himself as the fiscally conservative Democrat, which is just, you know, very misguided politically, and very, you know, very actually very misguided economically, I should say. It doesn't make economic sense,
But the conservative Dems need that.
Party.
But the conservative Dems need that so that they can say.
I don't understand what conservative Dems are, Rick. Honestly, like, to me, this whole debate about between, like, moderates and and conservatives within the party. I know it's vibrant and it exists and it's somewhat real, but I have a hard time coming to grips with it, considering there's actually, like, the other side is, like, actually, like, quasi-fascist and autocratic. So, like, the whole, like, the little infighting stuff seems so petty to me. Like, to me, like, you know, I do know what you mean, because, you know, he is taking out a deficit hawkish position in the middle for no reason. So I understand what you mean. But at the same time, like, I just feel like, I feel like Pete Buttigieg can say what he wishes about deficits, but, like, even if he did become president, the overwhelming consensus of economics would overwhelm him, to be honest, within the Democratic Party, even if he surrounded himself with, like, because even so-called conservative Democratic economists, like the Obama economists, are for deficit spending, and increasingly so, given the lack of wage response to stimulus. And so the consensus has moved so far in the other direction that I really don't think that there's room for there's no, that lane doesn't exist anymore.
Yes, I hope you're wrong, because I see it just a little bit differently. I see it as, you know, that constraint doesn't matter anymore, because you've got a Republican in the White House. You've got Donald Trump in the White House, who's brought us back to trillion-dollar deficits. At a time where this is supposedly, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, this is supposedly the greatest economy we're ever going to have. This is the best as it ever gets, and we're still hyper-stimulating the economy with a trillion extra dollars of spending.
Well, that's what's dangerous about the Buttigieg argument. I think we agree on that, to preemptively make that argument, that means that if when Democrats are in power and they do want a deficit spend, he's already kind of given them the soundbite, if you will, to attack any deficit spending of any sort, even if it's for beneficial and appropriate purposes, like fighting a recession or, you know, rebuilding our infrastructure, et cetera.
Because that's what scares me, Pedro. I mean, what scares me is you get someone like Buttigieg in, who's already, you know, like you've said, he's for no apparent reason jumped in the middle of this. And then, you know, if a recession does hit and we do need some pretty hefty, chunky spending, like I wished we would have gotten during the Obama term, then you end up with, you know, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, chain CPI. You end up with, you know, a lot of deficit reduction kind of things that really hurt the working class of this country.
I'm not sure. Again, I don't know, because I think this is as brutal as this internal Democratic battle has been. I really think it has shifted the center of the party a little bit to the left, to the point that, you know, while, you know, everybody is not a progressive in the Democratic Party, I just think it, especially on the economic side, maybe it's naive, but on the economic side, I have a hard time, because I talk to a range of economists, you know, I talk to economists who are pretty down the middle, including Wall Street economists who, you know, are comfortable with Trump, but who, just from a sound economy standpoint, would back economic policies that are more Democrat-like.
How so? I mean, you know, because they can't be comfortable.
In the sense, I'll give you an example. Jan Hatzius is the chief economist at Goldman Sachs. Okay, Jan Hatzius, to me, I don't know how he votes, but as far as his views and what he was saying during the recession and as to how much the government should be spending, he might as well have been a Democrat on the Joint Economic Committee, you know, or even to the left, because he was arguing for more aggressive QE, more aggressive stimulus, you know, and that was based on the economics of it. And so, you know, in the old line that we're all Keynesians now, right, when the recession hits, everybody
sure
deficit spending. And that wasn't, unfortunately, the case, because the Republicans went hard against it. But the economic consensus was very different. The economic consensus was actually pretty on the money.
Right. No, I don't disagree with you on that. I believe the economic community is on that page. My problem is the political class. And, you know, let's say you do have a Democrat in the White House and, you know, a Senate that's still controlled by Republicans. We end up, I think, in the same boat we were in during the Obama years, where he may have wanted to spend more, but you have a political class that wants him to fail.
That's very possible. But then let me ask you this. How do you envision a Sanders or a Warren presidency dealing with a Republican Senate? Because I also see room for kind of like this stasis of the sort that we see in Europe, if we get that kind of scenario. It could be very positive and progressive if there's like a widespread victory, right? But if
that's the hope. For me, that's the hope. The hope is if Sanders gets elected, that you maintain the House and you get at least parity, if not a small advantage in the Senate, which it gives you the ability to push your agenda. I think that's a possibility. But in a world where you end up with where we are now with divided government, I would prefer Sanders over Trump for the sole reason of Sanders is not crazy.
I'm with you there. I mean, yeah, I prefer a non-fascist over a fascist.
Yep. But the other part of it is, I know Sanders' record. And one of the knocks against him is, well, Sanders doesn't get anything done, which is completely not true. I know people who have served in Congress who said, look, Bernie Sanders has come to me with outstanding bills and said, look, you got to move this forward. You put your name on it. We'll support it. For him, it's not about putting his name on stuff. It was about getting things done. And I've heard that from numerous former congressmen who said, look, this guy behind the scenes is somebody who brings people together. So, you know, to me, that's part of the openness
that.
As well.
If you look at the squad, I mean, just look at how much I'm inspired by the squad, and the squad is inspired by him. So right there, you know, like just watching AOC introduce him, I'm inspired by her words and by her enthusiasm. Having grown up in Brazil and lived in Europe for part of my college years, I have this international perspective that like makes me wonder about how the world is going to see us. And I just wonder about global trust in the United States and about the long-term viability of any policy agenda and whether or not we're just going to ping pong from one side to the other, because we are so extreme. You know, whereas in Europe, they have more parliamentary systems that leave them more, for better or worse, that leave them more stuck in the middle. But here, I just like, you know, let's say we get your ideal world, you know, everything worked out, union rights, et cetera. What prevents the kind of a Republican takeover 8 years hence from like undoing all of it? I just wonder.
No, I'm with you. And look, this is what we've seen, Pedro, the last 40 years. What was the norm for many years during my grandparents' and my parents' generation, Reagan era forward, has thrown all of what was center of the road out the window, and we're moving to the shoulder, off to the right, off to the right of the road. And I'm with you on the, I don't want to become a country where we have wide swings in ideological policy, but that's by necessity, because as a country, in my view, we've marched further to the right as Democrats have done a poor job of maintaining, you know, that middle road. The Republicans,
that's absolutely right.
The Republicans have done a great job of moving the goalposts to the right. Give them credit.
100%. And the media and the way that the media covers it, you know, works out just fine. I mean, if you think about how often you hear the term the far left of the Democratic Party, how often do you hear the term the far right of the Republican Party, when in fact you have an extreme right-wing version of the Republican Party in power? But you never hear the term far right. You hardly ever hear the term right-wing.
Well, because I would argue that's the entire party right now. It's been hijacked.
Yeah.
They went through a process of homogenization, and they are all now primaried out to be the most extreme of the most extreme, and they have to maintain that because, you know yourself, in the past, you would run on some extreme things, then you'd get into office, and you would moderate a little bit. That moderation isn't happening anymore because there's the constant, the right of the right of the right is challenging and pushing them further and further.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about your conversation with Greg Palast. You remember Brian Kemp's gubernatorial ad?
Yep.
Where he was like pretending to round up immigrants in his pickup truck. I mean, it was grotesque. So yeah, it was quite downright fascist.
But when you get the purge, almost, and one report I saw as many as 700,000 names off the voter rolls, and according to Palast, over 340,000 of them were actual voters. When you get the purge that many people, maybe you don't care anymore.
Yeah, I guess not. I mean, kudos to Greg Greg, I've been following his work ever since The Best Democracy Money Can Buy back in the day, and he's been following this stuff since the hanging chad. So, and sadly, we haven't made much progress since those days. So
no, and to me, you know, coming back to this economic issue, you know, you see all of these economic indicators, and obviously, you're the expert in all of this, which is why I wanted you to come on, to, you know, to share some thoughts on some of the numbers that are being banged out, because I'm seeing the groundwork being laid for, hey, the economy is good, but when the recession hits or something bad happens, you know, we can't do anything. Like, for instance, I saw a story that said that, you know, for the first time, household debt in the country has raised to $14 trillion. And amongst young people, 18 to 29, it's well over, you know, $1 trillion. And they go through the student loan debt and the auto debt and, you know, all of these bubbles that are looking like they're about ready to pop. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, you know, is this something to be really concerned about, or are they just laying the groundwork for when, oh well, we can't do anything? As Pat Toomey said, we'll just need a harder down.
Yeah, well, the consumer debt isn't quite at as worrisome levels as they were in the prior crisis, so I wouldn't be as worried about that. Although, you know, there's always a difference between consumer debt at the higher level, at the higher end, and consumer debt at the low end, where, you know, a couple of missed payments can make or break, you know, a family's budget. The bigger worry for me, as far as the outlook, is corporate debt, which has really taken off in the wake of the Great Recession, because consumers kind of got a little bit scared and it took a while to recover on the consumer side, but corporations have loaded up on debt, and any change in the economic prospects of any particular sector could have fairly far-reaching consequences for the economy. So that's one of the things that I think Fed officials and folks on Wall Street are watching pretty closely.
And why is that? I mean, how is it the economy has changed so much? You know, again, from the stability of, you know, and you could, I guess we could argue if the golden era of the economy in the 50s and 60s were stable. But, you know, the idea of you know, people that I know who lived and worked during that era was, you know, you bought something, you paid for it, you used it, you invested in your business. Now it just seems like, you know, how much debt can we take on? How much can we leverage? You know, how much can we push it off on somebody else? And you're right. You know, these corporations are just loaded with debt that I guess they figure eventually the taxpayers will pick up.
Well, you know, it makes financial sense for them to borrow, you know, when interest rates are extremely low, and low interest rates are a double-edged sword, right? The Fed's in a difficult spot because on the one hand, you want interest rates to be low in order to
spur
maintain
investment.
Economic growth and spur, you know, job growth and wage growth at the bottom, but you don't want bubbles at the top to be, you know, blowing up and crashing over the economy. So, you know, as far as how did we get here, on the consumer side, how we got here was this whole discussion that we've been having about the erosion of workers' rights, the erosion of salaries and wages, that allowed the financial sector to step in and say, well, we can help you supplement your income here. And, of course, all kinds of newfangled credit products came into the picture, and that's how we became, you know, a credit society.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's really how we got here.
That's the crux of it.
And so, and you lay on, overlay on that a very unstable job market where people, you know, don't have any kind of job security, where their health care is tied to their job, et cetera, et cetera. And here we are.
So do you see the Fed making any move in the coming days? I mean, weeks, months?
What the Fed is watching is, you know, Jay Powell was asked about a bunch of different stuff. The thing that the markets and the Fed are really watching is this coronavirus and how much it's going to impact the Chinese economy and by extension the rest of the world. It's really hard to tell. Data out of China is suspect at best in the best of times. As we know, they're trying to, you know, contain the outbreak, but at the same time they suppress information, and the doctor that was the original whistleblower died. And so it's very hard to get details about which factories are reopening and which factories aren't. I get the sense that if there's any significant deterioration in the economy, the Fed will cut rates further. But they're in a tough spot now because, you know, stocks are hitting record highs over and over. So there are fears of a bubble. It's a really tight balance for them at this point.
Yeah. And also you've got a president who outwardly is attacking them for even considering raising rates.
What's that?
You got a president who's, you know, actually bullied them into cutting rates. I mean, if you think about it.
I don't think he actually bullied them, but he put them in a really difficult spot because, you know, I think, to be honest, I really think they would have done it anyway, and they really are looking at the data. But just by screaming at Jay Powell the way he does, A, he denigrates the institution, which is, by the way, one of our shining institutions, which allows our markets to be, you know, the shining glory of the world. And so just the way he spits on the Fed kind of just helps the weakening of our image globally and the strength of our economy, you could say, yeah, over time.
Yeah.
And it puts the Fed in a more difficult position in case it has to act. And the last thing that I would add is one of the reasons that monetary policy has become so important. I mean, I didn't grow up thinking I was going to be a Fed reporter, right? And watch these guys and pay attention to like every move in interest rates. Why did this become so central to economic policy? Because essentially we took fiscal policy out of the picture. We became, you know, a country in a world of austerity, and, you know, we stopped using other policy tools. And so monetary policy became the only game in town, and that's a very negative situation.
Yeah, excellent point. Pedro, as always, I appreciate the time, the expertise, and the knowledge. Good stuff, my friend.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Our good friend Pedro da Costa. He is a columnist for Forbes, also Market Watch, does a great bit of reporting over at Market News. Make sure you check out his work there. Quick break, right back. Stick around.